It's time!
Shot broken up in front, and what a slick backhand try right in front of Chris Mason. And now the quick pass down the middle, breaking in, and a backhand stop by Chris Mason. And Marlowe with a 2-on-1, a 3-on-1, and what a stop by Mason. Chichu right in front, and what a stop on Ekman by Mason.
Caroline, Willie, D. Mays, 102.5, 106.3, The Game in the Game Nashville app. We're streaming live on Twitch, Twitter, YouTube, and Facebook Live every single day. I'm on remote today. Willie D and D. Mays are at Barrel House at Bridgestone Arena. Game 6 tonight. And Nick Frazier is back at our Busy Bee Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning Game Nashville Studios, home of the $99 yearly Beehive membership, where the buzz is always about great service. Big one tonight, win or go home in a game 6 at Bridgestone Arena. And joining us now to break down what he's seen, what he wants to see tonight, is our friend Chris Mason. C-Mays, appreciate you for joining us today. I want to get into everything, but first, let's talk about the goalies. And let's start with UC Saros. UC Saros stole game 5 in Vancouver, but we've seen UC Saros not play maybe at the highest level that we would expect from UC Saros, so that what we know he is capable of. How would you evaluate Saros' performance so far through this series and what you want to see from him tonight, what the Preds need from him tonight?
Yeah, I think he's been good. I mean, I don't think there's any really, you know, game or circumstance where I would consider him bad. I would say maybe up until game 5, he hadn't stolen a game yet. And I think the guys, obviously they needed that. They got that in game 5. So I think he's been good. And I think if he can continue to play the way he did in game 5, I think that's what they need. It's you know, obviously goaltending is critical in a series that's this tight and this close. One save is the, you know, has shown that it's going to be the difference between a win and a loss here in this series. I would say that I feel the Predators have played better than the Canucks the last 3 games. But I'd also say that I think the Canucks have really maybe generated the higher danger scoring opportunities in terms of the quality of chance that they're getting. But again, it does boil down to goaltending. And, you know, last game was no different. It was a 1-goal hockey game. And I think Saros, you know, made some really key saves after the Preds tied it. And then once they got the lead, you know, he had to make those, you know, those timely saves at the right time. And he was able to do that. And they were able to hold on. I think they closed out. They handled the 6-on-5 a lot better too, as a unit, as a team. And I think that helps. So more of the same from Saros from last game, for sure.
It definitely does look like it's going to come down to who's the better goaltender, who can make some of the biggest saves. Chris Mason is with us. Let's flip over to the other side. It looks like Shelovs will be in net for the Canucks tonight. Again, no official word quite yet, but that's at least looking like what the conversation is. What did you make from him? A young and inexperienced goaltender, but I thought he made some pretty good saves in game 5. What's the best matchup and what's the best way to kind of take advantage of the fact that the Predators are facing a rather inexperienced goaltender tonight?
Well, I think, you know, we could have talked about this before too, but Vancouver's style of play really, I think, protects no matter what goaltender's in there. The key to me, against Shelovs, because I've noticed he's made some good saves. He's done what he's had to do to, you know, obviously win a game and keep them competitive in that last game and give them a chance. But there's a lot of rebounds. He gives up a lot of rebounds, especially low. If you remember that one shot, Forsberg came down the wing. He shot low far side, and it was a perfect rebound to Ryan McDonough, who kind of missed the shot. He had a wide open net, and he missed the net. But those types of plays, I think he can really be exploited. He also leaves a lot of pucks just lying there. You know, if he's got a clear sight, he's good. He'll catch it and hold on. But if it's off his body or off his pads, there's a lot of pucks just laying around the net. That's kind of how they got the power play goal. They outmanned him and went to the net on a puck that you know, Josi took to the net. There's a rebound line there, went behind him, and Nyquist jammed it in. He got hit. It was chaos. But there's a lot of those situations where there is opportunity. The puck is there. Their defense core, they're so big, and they're so good at clearing pucks out. Myers, Ian Cole, Zadorov, and their forwards really do a good job of coming back and helping out down low as well. But that's an area where the Predators have excelled at certain points this year, where they get inside, and it doesn't necessarily have to be Ryan O'Reilly all the time. They've done a good job when they've scored of different players getting to that area and winning those battles. That's what I'd like to see more of from them, is to somehow, it feels like they're kind of wearing down Vancouver a little bit, and they're starting to get more zone time. They're starting to get more chances, but that's an area where I think they could even dig deeper.
Talk with C. Mace, Chris Mason, one half of the broadcasting team for the Nashville Predators. Now, C. Mace, obviously they made the change to put Tyson Barrie in for the power play, and it seemed to have, you know, gave them a little bit more energy, or at least on a power play. The puck moved around a lot more fluently with him in it. But do you think that they choose to put him back in a power play, or do they choose to expand his role within this team in this series?
Well, this is the question tonight. I watched them practice this morning. What Tyson Barrie did is, when you have two defensemen on a power play, the Vancouver Canucks had been structured in a diamond, and with Josi being the only defenseman, he's usually up in the middle. And you have the Vancouver Canucks would have one guy always up there, really limiting what Josi is able to do with the puck and the time that he has. But when Barrie came out, they were able to start with two defensemen, one on each side. So it got their penalty kill to move. You had to bring another player up top into more of a box type of a structure to kill the penalties, and it kind of got them running around, and that allowed them to move into whatever, you know, the umbrella where you have two flanks and then that quarterback up top. But what it did was it moved the Vancouver Canucks penalty kill around and opened up lanes for the Predators to start making passes through and really getting them, in a defensive mode where the Predators had control. And they got set up and they got some good looks, and obviously they got the goal. They got momentum, I think, from that. So it'll be interesting to see if he goes in. I don't know exactly, you know, what Shen's situation is, or whether, you know, Andrew Burnett wants to take an approach where you dress 7D, for example, or the way they practice with Novak on the first unit this morning. They practice with Barrie on the first unit, and they practice with Carey on the first unit. So they're trying a bunch of different looks. But a couple of those sets were with the 2D-man on the first unit, I think, for the reason that you saw in the last game, is when they started to have success. They got Vancouver out of their comfort zone, out of their plan that's worked so well against the Predators' power play. So, I mean, Barrie was definitely impacted the game on the power play. So that's, that's a special team that could win or lose, you know, a series. So I think that's something that's going to be strongly considered from Bruno. We'll have to see which way he decides to go tonight.
Now, do you believe one of these strategies, now speaking about Tommy Novak, one of these strategies is to sort of move him around, to put him in an advantageous state for him, that he can go out and play the brand of hockey that he's accustomed to playing? Because it seems like Vancouver has been able to slow him down using the rough and tough play on him. So moving him around, trying to get him, you know, loose a little bit, because Coach Bruno did talk about, you know, he got a little bit better. We saw some things in him two games ago. Last game wasn't quite what we expected, but just trying to put him in situations where he can flourish.
Oh, I think, you know, it's a great point, because I think he's a player that, you know, he's got a certain set of offensive skills that not everybody on the team does. He's he can make plays. If he can get the puck in, if they can find a way, or he can find a way to create time for himself to make plays, you know, like any good player, he's going to find that open man. He's going to make the play. But the difficulty in this series is he hasn't been able to find that time. You mentioned the rough and tumble. Vancouver, every chance they get, if you're playing against a skilled player like Novak, you're trying to finish that play and finish that player every chance you get. And you could see it's kind of taken a toll, and it's been effective, I think, in really limiting what, you know, he's been able to do. And Andrew Burnett does want to try to get him in a situation, start him on offensive zone faceoffs. He'll have a better opportunity at home here when to disperse, you know, a player like Novak and maybe put him in those advantageous situations, as you mentioned. He'll have a little bit of an easier job doing that here at home. But, you know, he's hoping that if he does that, he's going to need a play. Somebody's got to make a play. He's one of the players that, you know, has that skill set and the ability to create something, you know, even when, you know, Vancouver's in the right spots and, you know, they're doing all the right things. You need players to be able to make plays. And he's one of those guys that, you know, you kind of just, you keep waiting for him to be able to, you know, contribute on a, you know, an offensive situation, which is, you know, that's his bread and butter. That's, you know, that's the situations that he's going to be put out there, and that's what's expected of him. So hopefully if they keep, you know, keep at that and he does continue to get better, he'll be able to make a play and help them move on.
Chris Mason with us talking about game six, which is coming up tonight at 6 o'clock. Doors open at 3 o'clock. Very busy night downtown. So again, we'll reemphasize what we've been talking about. If you're coming down to the game, make sure you give yourself extra time. Get here early. The doors will be open. And get ready for what's going to be, I think, a really, really good hockey game. So, Mace, one thing you've pointed out several times during the series is it's clear what Vancouver is trying to do. 5-on-5 and definitely when they're on the power play. And that's a lot of cross-ice action, being selective when they shoot, and looking for, if there are not great shooting lanes, they're trying to play the puck in front of the net, looking for sticks, that second stick, as Rick Tocchet calls it, trying to bumper it towards the net. And it feels like Nashville has gotten a little bit better feel for it as the series has gone along. But talk about that dynamic, because that's the cat and mouse game that, as you go further, you wonder if Rick Tocchet's going to yo-yo back and say, guys, just blast it on net. Let's get traffic and go back in that direction. That's what I'm looking forward to tonight.
Well, yeah, me too. And I think it's one of those things that's a balance, because, you know, you saw those two late goals in game four. That's exactly what they did. It was cross ice stuff. It was pucks to the, not on net, but to the middle traffic that ended up deflecting through, and Besser ended up getting his own kind of rebound there on the game tying one. But the other one was a backdoor empty net type of a goal. They've tried that. And it's worked. They've had a bunch of near misses, but that's what happens. You're going to miss a lot of those attempts as well. But I feel in game five that the Predators really adapted and adjusted well to that. They probably went to the well a little too much, because every time they come to the ice, they're, you know, flinging it across. And I thought the Predators were ready. I thought Saros did a good job of anticipating that, although he did get caught on the only goal that he let in. Zadorov, he, you know, and was kind of leaning to the middle, expecting a pass, and Zadorov made a great shot. You got to credit him. You know, nobody thinks a defenseman's going to come down and try to, you know, pick that spot, but he did a good job of looking to the middle. Now, I think Vancouver, what they're going to do is, it's like anything. It's, if you have a guy that's a pass-first guy and he passes all the time, well, you know how to defend him. You just lean, you give him the space, and you lean to the passing options. Until he shoots, you don't respect the shot, because you know he's gonna pass that puck. So if Vancouver's passing every time, the Predators adapted. They lean more to finding the pass options and that type of thing. Now, Vancouver, I think, after hearing Rick Tocchet talk after the game, he says they've got to have more shot first. If the shot's there, you kind of take what's given to you. Don't force those pucks into the coverage if it's not there. So I expect them to start shooting a little more. And then if they're able to do that, then naturally the Predators are going to have to respect the shot, and maybe those options will open up for them. But we'll have to see, you know, how Vancouver comes out at the start of the game and what their approach is in that regard. But yeah, it's definitely one of the biggest things I'll be looking for.
One thing that sometimes, you know, I think we lose sight of, at least where I sit, right, is how much goes into shot blocking. And I know Hal Gill has talked over and over, we've learned a lot about shot blocking from Hal Gill. But you, as a goalie, you know, you appreciate good shot blocking in front of you. Rick Tocchet said this. He goes, if they are going to block a shot, it's got to hurt. And you heard Andrew Burnett saying in game two, when they blocked over 30 shots, he goes, we embraced the pain that comes with blocking shots. You have to, it's a human nature to say, ooh, I don't want to get in front of that thing. It's going to hurt. Mm-hmm. But that's what it takes sometimes to win, right?
Well, that's the difference in winning and losing sometimes. And I think, you know, that's the one thing about this series that's impressed me the most is there's a lot of talk about low event and, you know, the amount of shots or maybe the lack of shots in the series. A lot of that has to do with two teams that are able to defend well, but a lot of that, part of defense is blocking shots and having the willingness, both forwards and defensemen, to get in front and take that pain and being willing, you know, to sacrifice. And it's one thing to want to block shots. It's like any other skill. You've got two teams that are highly skilled and willing to put their bodies on the line in their shot blocking. And I think that's really shown. So with the lack of shots on goal, a historic low, I think, out of Vancouver's side, what was it, 92 out of five games. But it's not, there's not a lot of lanes there on both sides. You know, you get that puck, there's been a lot of zone time. Both teams have had, you know, pretty even amounts of zone time, but there's just not lanes there because every single player on both teams is willing to put their body in front. It's just the effort and the extra, willingness to put your head in front of a puck. Guys are diving head first. Like, it's crazy. These guys are nuts. And it's made for an extremely physical, defensive type of a series that's just been, quite frankly, really fun and impressive to watch.
It is amazing to watch, for sure. So, Mace, one thing that we heard Andrew Brunette said in the pregame before game five, and I think he reiterated something. He finds these different phrases that I think are all really interesting to hear, but it's all saying the same thing. He said, anybody can grab a moment. And that's a great way to say what you see sometimes in the playoffs, right? It would be great if the guys who are the bigger scorers scored tonight, but you would take a big play from anybody tonight. And, you know, one big play, as you said, could tip the scales for you, but that's the beauty of hockey. And it was Andrew Brunette himself way back in the day, right? He was not a well-known guy in 2003. He ended up scoring the last goal that Patrick Waugh ever gave up, right? And they pulled a huge upset, Minnesota over Colorado. I just wonder, you know, how that plays in tonight. Who's going to be the guy?
Well, that's what they need. That, you know, I think it's such a evenly played series. I think game one, it was the Lindholm line of a couple guys that are just, you know, blue collar guys that have been actually contributing offensively, but it's not their main guys. You know, a couple of the other wins, they had Besser and Miller, you know, were the front and center. But I think the Predators, when they've had success and when they went on that big point run, you know, it could have been anybody. You know, Evangelista had some moments. The McCarron line with Sherwood and Cole Smith, who are not relied upon for, you know, their offensive prowess, you know, were scoring goals and they're contributing in big ways during that run and ever since then. So it's they've shown, like, you know, this team has shown that it can be anybody, and anybody has, you know, stepped up and kind of been, front and center in those moments. So I think that's good. And I think a lot of what you're hearing from Andrew Brunette, the players, is, hey, they've been in this situation before throughout the season. They're relying on that. This is a team that believes there's a certain calm. I think, you know, even after they went down 3-1, I just felt there's just no panic in Andrew Brunette, no panic in the players' mentality. They're just going to go out and win a game. And it's, you know, they're comfortable being uncomfortable. And that's what Andrew Brunette says. You got to be comfortable being uncomfortable. And I think this team is. And I think, you know, it's the story tonight. It's going to be who's it going to be? If it's nobody, they're done. So somebody's got to step up and make it happen. That's the reality of it, right? That's the reality.
Yep.
Yep.
100%. Chris Mason is with us. C. Mace, I know a lot of Preds fans are going into this game with a lot of trepidation, a lot of anxiety, because the Predators dropped both games at Bridgestone Arena. They come back home, and I guess the series has shown us home ice doesn't really mean much since the road team has won the last four games of the series. What do you take away from that? Do you put any stock into that?
I don't put any stock into what's already happened, because it's already happened and there ain't nothing you can do about it. So, who would have thought that the Canucks or the Preds were going to go in and win, you know, those last two games in Vancouver? It just doesn't matter. The only thing that matters, you could make an argument, the Predators should have won game four. They didn't. They blew it at the end. They played better in game three there as well. But they didn't win. And it just comes down to one game. That's my key tonight, is just get one. That's all you can do. The only thing that matters is this game at home. If they can win one game at home at Bridgestone Arena, you can force a game seven. So those other games don't matter. This is the only game that matters. If they win one out of three, if you're looking back and say, well, you only won one out of three, you know, against the Canucks, well, you still gave yourself a chance to win the series. So that's where my head would be at as a player. I wouldn't even be thinking about those other games, to be honest with you.
Not just get one game, but maybe just one goal could do it. In a series that has been so tightly contested, maybe just one goal could do the trick. C-Mace, appreciate you for stopping by. Enjoy the game tonight, and we'll catch up with you next week.
Okay, thank you, guys. Take care.
I appreciate it. C-Mace, Chris Mason stopping by here on the program. We will continue to get back into Predators thoughts. We'll get back into your Predators phones and texts. But coming up next, ask D-Mace. So get those questions in for D-Mace. 615-737-1025 is our phone number. If you have a question for D-Mace, we'll take your calls, we'll take your texts, and everything is on the table. Ask D-Mace coming up next. Caroline Willie D-Mace is brought to you by Zen Sports. Start earning cash rewards on your bets today. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-889-9789. Terms and conditions apply. Must be 21 or older and in Tennessee to bet.
G-Mace. He played 15 years in the NFL.
Quick throw. Touchdown, Derek Mason.
He had over 12,000 receiving yards.
Midfield, and there he goes. 80 yards for the touchdown.
And now you can ask him anything. Question about football or life? Now's your time to ask D-Mace.
We'll welcome you in.
Now on Caroline, Willie, and
D-Mace.
On 102.5 and 106.3, The Game and the Game Nashville app.
All right, get those questions in for D-Mace. 615-737-1025 is our phone number. We'll take your calls. We will take your texts. We will take all of your questions for D-Mace. Our phone lines are driven by WilsonCountyHyundai.com. And one texter texts in with a question for D-Mace.
Let's do it.
Says, why doesn't the screen pass work in the NFL like it does in every other division or level? Is it a lack of good blocking, or does it just click with these defenders and all of a sudden they can stop it?
Well, I mean, you know, in college, high school is a lot different because it's based upon competition. You know, you're going to play in college, you're going to play a lot of teams, or half of your schedule is going to be teams, especially if you're a good team. It's going to be against teams that you are superior over, that doesn't have as much talent across the board than you. So some plays may come a little bit easier in a sense of how you block them and able to get out to those linebackers. In the NFL, I think, you know, speed is a big component of why, you know, screen plays are not routinely used or as successful. Now, you're going to get some teams. That's just the way it is. But you have to be strategically correct in how you run your screen plays, because it's all a setup. You can't just come out and just start running screen plays all willy-nilly. You got to set screen plays up. And in the NFL, even though you've set them up, you know, the chances that I recover on defense is greater than the chances for a college kid or a high school kid to, you know, be going one way and then realize, oh, my goodness, it's a screen, and try to scrape back over and get it. They may not be, you know, foot speed, or from a, you know, mental standpoint, they may not be able to read it as good. But in the NFL, I mean, you're going against the best of the best. And this is all these guys do, is study and watch film. So when you set up your screenplay, you better have had run several different plays in that sort of that same formation to set up your screenplays. So I think that's why screenplays in the NFL, where they do work, but they may not work as, you know, well as you may see them work in the college ranks or in high school. It's just, you know, guys are more aware. This is their job. So you are expected to know, you know, to recognize offenses and offensive sets when you go on the field.
And even if it does, you know, quote unquote, work, whether that means picking up a couple of yards, whether that means a completion, whether that means picking up a first down, it's not really sexy to talk about. Like, it's not going to be making any SportsCenter top tens whenever there's, you know, 40, 50 yard deep passes that you're seeing in any given Miami game. So it's not going to be really, you know, talked about. But another texter texts in and says, Derek, I asked someone else this yesterday. Want your take on it. I know that they're months away from taking the field, but why is it that year after year after year, knowing how critical an offensive line is to the success of any offense, are the Titans continually in the position of not being able to find competent O-linemen? That's the multi-million dollar question.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, let me go back quickly, just say a quick thing about the screens. They do run screens, but they're ran a little bit different now because you have a lot of wide receiver screens. But the traditional screen to a running back, they don't use it as much. They would rather throw it out to the receiver because they feel the receivers can get the yards. And plus, he's out in space. But back to the offensive lineman. I don't know. And this is the question that, you know, we've been trying to answer for the last couple of years. I could say, you know, some of it is due to injury. You know, some of it is due to the team not wanting to re-sign, you know, guys, Jack Conklin, some other guys within there. You know, they just hadn't been able to develop the offensive lineman. And I think a part of it, too, is the college game is a lot different. And then when you come to the pros, you don't have as much time to spend with these offensive linemen. And I do firmly believe that, and there hasn't been any, you know, case study on this or anything, but I do believe that because they've taken days away from you being able to meet as a team, it has hurt the offensive line position more than any other position on the football field.
And to give the Titans at least a shred, an iota of credit,
yeah,
they've tried.
Yeah, they've tried.
Isaiah Wilson, a big old swing and a miss. Mm-hmm. They draft Dylan Raiden in the second round of the 2021 draft, and he's not a starter in this league. They've tried to find solutions to those positions. It just hasn't worked, which might be worse than just completely ignoring it altogether.
Yeah, not trying. So, and then, but then you can go to, well, have they had the coaching they needed to develop as blockers? Well, that's, you know, you can sit here and debate that, but we all know, you know, the last couple of years, it doesn't seem like they had the coaching, but we believe they have it now in Bill Callahan.
I was wondering when he was going to call in. Eric is on the line with a question for D-Maze. What's up, Eric?
Yeah, and I've also got a bad joke, and I'm going to give you a heads up in advance. This one might be a groaner, so get ready.
Okay. Those are the best dad jokes.
Yeah. So, guys, you know, the dogs are very intelligent creatures, and they can do a lot of things, you know, but there's one thing dogs can't do. You know, they're not good at reading an MRI. Only cats scan.
I like that one, cat.
That's a good one,
Aaron.
I wasn't sure. I thought this one might be a groaner. So, but guys, my question for the Titans is, you know, and you were talking about, and I know a lot of people have been talking about the wide receiver position. Mm-hmm. And of course, Tyler Boyle was here and he left and didn't sign a contract. I heard reports they're offering like $9 million. I don't know what's going to happen, but do you think they might sign him or another wide receiver, and what does that mean for Treylon Burks? Because I'm hearing, of course, this regime did not originally draft him. Some people think this maybe is last year. They don't know if he'll have a shot or whatever. There's just not a lot of tape on him. But how do you think all this is shaking out for him? Because I know you got thoughts on that. Guys, y'all take care. Have a great weekend.
Thank you, Eric. Appreciate it. For one, Eric, don't – listen, the stuff that came out yesterday just – put all that stuff to the side. People were tweeting, oh, you know, Tyler Boyd signed, he's going to sign, and here's the parameters of the deal. All that was hogwash. Wasn't none of it real. So no one knows what's going on. Only thing we know is that he visited the Tennessee Titans yesterday. We assume he's not here anymore. We assume that he's not a part of the team because there hasn't been any press release saying that he's been signed. There hasn't been, you know, insider saying he's been signed. So I don't know if he's going to sign or not. You know, we won't know until, you know, his name is on a dotted line whether he's going to sign or not. So all of that you saw yesterday, forget all that stuff, Eric. It means nothing. I don't know if they're going to sign him. I really don't. I've said, you know, the past couple of days that I wouldn't be opposed to signing him, but there's no rush to sign him, you know, because you want to see what you have in that room moving forward. And if you find out that the guys, or we need to add another guy, then you can add that other guy. I don't think Tyler Boyd, at least I don't expect him to sign, you know, within the next week or two. Maybe he does, maybe he doesn't. But you have time to sit back and sort of let this thing play out, at least in my eyes, because it's not like you are a Tyler Boyd away from, you know, being the best team or one of the best teams in the AFC and in the NFL alone.
Yeah, you know, Tyler Boyd's not a go-for-it move.
Exactly.
You have a ton of texts in the text line. Questions for you, D-Mays. And really kind of just a summary of what the questions are is, how much better, and would Tyler Boyd make the Titans better?
Of course he'll make, of course he will make their passing game on paper better. Why? Because he's a veteran guy that has played really good football. He's been a part of a winning team there in Cincinnati. Obviously, we know the Cincinnati Bengals went to the Super Bowl, and he was a part of that Super Bowl win. That Super Bowl representing team for the AFC, ultimately they didn't win, came close. So adding Tyler Boyd to the mix would be a plus. It's not going to be a minus because he's a guy that, again, he's logged in a lot of minutes. He's played some really good football. He's had two back-to-back 1,000-yard seasons. I'm not saying he would have another 1,000 yards, but his contribution, I think, would be felt on this team or any other team. So I think it would be a good addition, but it's, again, it's not going to make or break the Titans if they don't sign him.
Andrew Texan says, D-Mace, are NFL players truly intimidated by any other players in the league? Like, would Ed Reed make you really think about running a certain route?
No, I mean, when you, okay, let me say this, because I'm only speaking for myself. There was nobody that ever intimidated me in the game of football, ever. Now there are some guys that, you know, you tell them to go across the middle and they develop alligator arms for some reason, or they shrink it, or they don't want to go in that middle. I get that. So I don't know if that's intimidation or just, I don't know, just being afraid to go across the middle no matter who's there. But I can't see a guy being intimidated. At least I didn't know of a guy that was intimidated by another guy. Now, you respect the guy's ability to play the game or play his position. You respect that, and you prepare accordingly. But I don't think there's a guy that another guy has been intimidated by, at least guys that I play with. I don't know, you know, guys that I didn't play with, I don't know. But guys that I play with, they were not intimidated by an opposing player or a team.
If you think there are probably some young guys out there, maybe, you know, I'm sure Dylan Raiden might be a little intimidated by an Aaron Donald, so to speak.
And I don't think that as an example.
A young guy versus an established veteran.
Yeah, I don't think it's intimidation. It's just, I think the first thought in your mind is like, wow, like I watched this guy play. Like, I've been watching him play for, like, the last 8 years, and I've idolized him. That's what comes in your head first. Like, oh, my goodness, I'm playing against a guy that I idolize. That comes in your head first. And then it's going against Aaron Donald, how do I protect my quarterback? How do I make sure I'm doing the right things from a technique standpoint? And then once that happens, it's just once you get off the ball – all that stuff goes out the window. There's no, I'm not afraid. All that stuff goes out the window. Why? Because you're concentrating on your priority, your technique, your assignment. That's what you're concentrating on. You're not concentrating on, you know, that's Aaron Donald. Oh my goodness. Well, yeah, before the snap, but after the snap, you just got to block. He becomes
a
name and a face. That's all. It's business.
Yeah. Wes in Clarksville texts in with a very important question, D-Mace.
Let's go.
Says, who would you take to a Morgan Wallen concert, Jared Stillman or Paul Kuharsky?
Who would I take to a Morgan Wallen? For one, I wouldn't go to a Morgan Wallen concert. I just wouldn't. But if I had to go, wow. Can I say I would take neither one of those jokers?
If you wanted to sort of life miserable for whoever the artist was, those guys I think could be really good hecklers.
Yeah, they would be. You know what? I think I would take Stilly. I take Stilley. I think I would have – not to say I wouldn't have a good time with Paul, but I think that's more so of Stillman's age group, you know. So I take Stillman, and, you know, he may know some people there, some younger people to get together, and we all start cheering and, you know, doing whatever you do in concerts. I don't know.
But I take Stillman. You think Paul might complain a little bit too much?
I think Paul may complain. He may complain. People are too close. People are too loud. Why are you on my back? Why are you drinking a beer? All that stuff.
These people are too close.
Exactly.
The lights are too bright.
Paul would complain the whole time. And I don't have time for that. So I would take Stilley.
Nobody's got time for that. All right.
I love you,
getting
Paul.
Back into your questions for D-Maze coming up next. 615-737-1025 is our phone number. If you have got a question for D-Maze, we'll take your calls. And, of course, we will take your texts as well. Join 1025 The Game for Kubota Orange Days at the grand opening of Coleman Tractor of Nashville's newest location tomorrow. Stop by anytime from 9 to 2 p.m. for demos, deals, and giveaways. Lunch is from 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. and 1025 The Game will be there on site from 10 a.m. to noon. So stop by and see us at Coleman Tractor of Nashville's newest location, 7221 Whites Creek Pike in Joelton. Tune in to 94.9 The Fan today as the Nashville Sounds take on the Norfolk Tide at First Horizon Park. Pre-game at 6:20 p.m., first pitch at 6:35, with coverage also available on 94.9 The Fan app and at 94.9thefan.com. Sounds baseball on 94.9 The Fan, presented by Twin Peaks Family Leisure and Busy Bee Plumbing, Heating, and Air Conditioning. We'll catch up with Adam Vingan at the top of the hour in just over 10 minutes. He has a recent article put out on sportsnet.ca, kind of breaking down the offensive struggles that you've seen both Vancouver and Nashville have throughout the first five games of the series. So Adam Vingan will join us in just about 10 minutes, but we are right back into your questions for D. Mace. One texter texts in and asks the question, what do you think is worse, D. Mace? Missing on offensive linemen or missing on quarterbacks every time, like the Cleveland Browns?
What is worse, missing on offensive linemen or missing on quarterbacks? That's easy, missing on your quarterback, because it sets you back. Missing on the offensive lineman, I mean, it's not a good thing to miss on offensive lineman, but I think you have more chances to hit it with an offensive lineman because you can draft an offensive lineman in consecutive rounds, or if it doesn't work, I can come back and draft an offensive lineman the next following year. And sort of, if a guy doesn't work out at tackle, you can probably shift him down and put him at guard or something like that. So, whereas you may have missed on him at the tackle position or some other position, maybe he can play a different position within that line. Quarterback is a quarterback. He ain't playing no different position. And if you miss on him, you got to start the clock all over again, and which puts you further and further behind everybody else that has quarterback. So the obvious answer is missing on your quarterback. That would be more detrimental to a team. And then let's go back to that Stilley and Paul question. Another reason why I wouldn't take Paul, because it would be kind of weird seeing two 50-year-old guys sitting there
at a Morgan Wallen. A little bit of younger.
Exactly.
Crowd.
I would rather take Stilley and they can say, oh, that's his uncle or something, you know, like he's taking his nephew to the game, you know. I'm like, yeah, Stilley's my nephew.
Have you been marinating on this over the break?
Yes, I have been.
It's a very difficult question.
Exactly.
It needed a little bit of thought.
Yeah, I needed to think about it a little bit more. So
That's on me maybe for just dropping that on you. I should have given you a little bit of a warm-up period. To maybe do a Venn diagram, the pros and cons of each.
Exactly.
That's truly the most important question of the day. Tom's on the line with a question for D-Mace. Thanks for calling in, Tom.
Hi, D-Mace.
Hey, what's going on, Tom?
When you were in the NFL, did you collect any sports memorabilia from other players? If so, what?
Did I collect sports memorabilia from any other players while I was playing? Yes, I got jerseys, obviously, from the guys that I played with, you know, great players, Eddie, Bruce, Steve, you know, Javon, guys like that, Samari, that I played with, Ray, Ed, those guys. But as far as memorabilia, not necessarily from guys that I play with or guys within the NFL, I know I got my son a pair of Muhammad Ali signed gloves, and I got those as a welcome to this world gift.
So cool.
For my son, Derek, when he was born. It just so happened that night I had a charity event, and I love Muhammad Ali. So those gloves are right there, and I bid on them, and I won, and I gave them to my son. So those are
cool.
Those are like the most prized memorabilia pieces that I have. Those gloves that I got with my son, and then a Kobe Bryant signed jersey that I got as a present some years ago. I cherish that too. Obviously, Kobe's not here no more, but he was my favorite player. So. Other than Magic Johnson.
Something to cherish no matter what, but especially exactly. Means a little bit more. Getting back into some of your questions for D-Maze, Bob Texan says, interesting question. Says, would it work for both sides of some player contracts in the NFL, particularly quarterbacks, if they were tied to a percentage of the salary cap rather than set dollar amounts?
If it was tied to a percentage of the salary cap, like you had to pay them a percentage of it? And is like, that what he's saying? Like it wasn't necessarily like a 5-year, $150 million contract. It would just be like 3% of what the salary cap number is. Is that what he's saying?
That's what I think that he's saying, that 3% over the next 5 years.
Yeah, I'm not sure that owners would go for that, even though, you know, if it's sort of that way anyway, because if you look at their contracts, if you go to SpotRack, it does break down what percentage of their contract is sort of takes up the salary cap. Some guys, it takes up 10% of the salary cap. Some guys take up 2% of the salary cap. So it is there, but the contracts are not based upon percentages. It's, you know, we're not signing a 5-year contract worth 3% of what the salary cap is. I'm not sure guys or, you know, owners would go for that, because that becomes a little tricky trying to do contracts for higher end guys as well as lower end guys.
And let's keep in mind, too, whenever the CBA changes or the salary cap adjusts as well.
Yeah. And we do. Go ahead, Caroline. Go ahead. I was going to say we do get a percentage of the salary cap, like the money that is coming in. It's not necessarily a salary cap, but the money that is coming into the NFL, we do as players get a percentage of that. Yeah. I think it's like 51%.
Right. That's how in general they determine what the salary cap
absolutely.
Is. Is it, they take the league revenues. This is how most leagues do it. They take the pie, right, and say, here's all the money coming in to make up the pie.
Uh-huh.
And the players get 51%.
And the owners get
49.
Yeah.
And that's how they say, all right, here's how – there's how it works out per team. Here's your salary cap ceiling.
I think if I was a player, I would like it. If I was an owner, I wouldn't.
Yeah, owners.
The best part about the salary cap for an owner is it protects you from yourself.
Exactly.
It guarantees that you're going to break even or make money, basically. If you just stick to that, say, here's your money that you're going to pay to players, it's based on the league revenues, then you basically can't go wrong. And everything, and there's other sources of revenue for the owners that make it even easier for them to make money hand over fist.
Yeah, because it allows the business model to proceed more fluently, because if there isn't a percentage of a salary cap, you're not going to have a lead for the long time. That's why, you know, in the 80s, why they went on strike, because the players were not getting a percentage of the salary cap. So they wanted the league revenue. They wanted
a percentage.
They couldn't
go to free agency.
Exactly. Yeah. So it was beneficial to the owners, but it wasn't beneficial to the players. And if it's not beneficial to the players, you're not going to have a league. So that's why every 10 years, I think that's what it is, they redo the collective bargaining deal, because the money gets bigger, which means the players, you know, want more money. They deserve more money because they are the ones that are out there putting their bodies on the line. They are the ones that the fans are coming to see, not the owners.
They're the product.
Yeah.
And I do think that that would be a model that would be make more sense if it was adopted by the NHL rather than the NFL, because NHL contracts are so cut and dry that this is the term, this is the money, and you're going to make that money. In the NFL salary cap, there are so many different layers to it: guaranteed money, incentives, deferred money, money up front. There's so many weird little things that you can do to manipulate it that if we're adding percentages in the mix, it's making my brain hurt just thinking about it. Percentages are hard. It's money. Everybody knows dollars and cents.
Exactly. Math in general is just, it does make your head hurt. At least does mine.
Yes, 100%, especially doing math on the air. I'm out on that. All right, Adam Vingan will join us coming up next. We will preview Game 6 tonight at Bridgestone Arena, a gotta-have-it game for the Predators. Puck drop at 6 p.m. All of your pregame coverage starting right here on 102.5 and 106.3. The game starting at 5 p.m. Start getting to Bridgestone Arena now. Start bugging Willie and D-Mace at Barrel House now. Get that place rowdy. Adam Vingan will join us coming up next. We'll preview Game 6, and we'll also break down his most recent article on Sportsnet. Why is offense so hard to come by? Get into that coming up next with Adam Vingan, Caroline, Willie, D-Mace, 102.5, 106.3 The Game.